I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story. As the race to the White House kicks into overdrive, there's a clear message coming from President Donald Trump.
Because the only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged. Remember that.
If he loses, the election is rigged.
It's the only way we're going to lose this election.
Ballots and electoral fraud have been hot topics for Donald Trump in recent weeks.
You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
But these claims from the president are unfounded. In fact, the very opposite is happening. Problems with mail-in ballots, millions being removed from the electoral register, and voter intimidation are just some of the issues plaguing this election. Today, how Americans could be stopped from voting altogether. It's Tuesday, the 27th of October.
Over the past year, Sam Levine has been looking at the ways in which Americans across the country might find it hard to cast a ballot.
Anushka Astana is the host of Today in Focus, where this episode first aired.
For many, the fight begins long before Election Day, sometimes years before.
She's talking to Sam Levine, The Guardian's voting rights reporter.
I met Alfonso Tucker back in February.
Yes, sir. My name is Alfonso Tucker Jr., 53 years old.
He's a black man, and he lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. In the late 1980s, he was convicted of one crime.
Back in 1988, me and my brother was involved with a fight at this nightclub called the Citizen Club. I was arrested on second-degree assault.
And then again in the early 1990s, of another crime, both involved fights, and he wound up going to prison for 2 years.
And that I had to pay.
He told me that when he was in prison, he really had a kind of awakening.
Inmate had a book on accomplishment of African-American leaders, and there I read about Mega Evans, and I was kind of taken back about it because we never read about him in school. And I never knew anything about him.
Medgar Evers, he's a legendary civil rights leader here in the U.S.
We are ready for freedom, and we are ready to march for it. All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom. And when we get this unity...
famously led voter registration drives in Mississippi and was assassinated.
15 minutes past midnight, Evers got out of his car beside his home in a Negro residential area. In a vacant lot about 40 yards away, a sniper fired a single shot from a high-powered rifle at Evers' silhouette. The bullet hit him in the back, crashed through his body, through a window into the house. He died within an hour at a Jackson hospital.
When I read that, that inspired me. And I was saying, this must be something to this voting thing, that they were willing to take his life.
Before he went to prison, he wasn't someone who really thought about voting that much.
Because that I didn't really care, to be honest with you, about voting. I wasn't into that.
Had you ever voted before you went to prison?
No.
And when he got out of prison, he really felt this compulsion to vote.
It just inspired me enough to want to try to find the means actually to get myself registered.
And he did start voting then, didn't he? But what happened next?
In 2013, he suddenly got a letter from the state of Alabama saying that he was ineligible to vote.
I had been voting since 1998. It was during 2012 that I voted for the last time. The Pardon and Parole Board sent me a letter, I think it was in March of 2013, saying that I could no longer vote because I was a convicted felon.
Wow, so he'd been voting for 14 years and then suddenly that was taken away from him. Did he say how he felt about that?
It affected his whole family.
I was taken back by it, you know, because me and my wife both, we always used to go vote together. And we always took our children with us when we go to the polls. And so I was very disappointed and very hurt by it, really, to be honest with you.
But it wasn't just him, was it?
When his son turned 18, his son, who's also named Alfonso Tucker.
He's Alfonso F. Tucker III.
Got a letter.
And they sent him a letter saying that he was a convicted felon.
From the state that said he was ineligible to vote. And
why not?
There was an obvious mix-up.
Yeah, then basically they got me confused with my dad. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even have a misdemeanor.
He has no criminal
No criminal record. You know, he was born in 97. I was born in 67. We 30 years apart. We two different individuals.
And that, Alfonso said, really lit a fire under him.
And was that what started this process for you? Was it your son getting that letter that got you back on the process towards figuring out how you could get your voting rights
back? Sir. Yes, sir. Glad you asked that. Yes, sir. It did lit a fire up under me. I started thinking about Mega Evers and the challenges that he went through in Decatur, Mississippi.
And to hear him say that, even, you know, I interviewed him in 2020, and this was some years ago, I could still see how much it pained him to see his son, he felt, being punished because of what his father had done. So Alfonso Tucker became determined to get his son's voter registration sorted out, and he was able to do that. But that really made him want to figure out what was going on with his own voting rights.
Gosh, so they will easily put barriers in the way of people voting, even if sometimes they're done incorrectly. Alfonso's son off the list for something his dad did 30 years ago. What did Alfonso find out about his own situation?
Alabama is one of several states in the U.S. that if you have a felony conviction, you have to pay off all financial obligations that you owe as part of that crime. And that was what was standing in the way of Alfonso Tucker being able to vote. The state told him that he owed $131.10 as part of his decades-old felony convictions if he wanted to vote again. And Alfonso borrowed the money from his sister. And after he did that, he went to the clerk's office and they presented him with another notice that said, actually, you owe more than $5,535 if you want to vote again.
And what was that for?
Well, he didn't know what that was for at first. And it was only after Alfonso Tucker contacted a lawyer in Washington, D.C., that he was able to figure that out. And it took the lawyer 15 minutes to see that there was just a bureaucratic mix-up. When the lawyers looked into it, they found out that all he owed as part of his outstanding debts was $4 ahead of the 2018 midterms. And if the state of Alabama had told him that, he would have been able to vote.
What was it like when you got that phone call? She called you back 15 minutes later. It took her
15 minutes later, yeah.
To see through this whole thing.
Right.
And $4.
Right. I was blown away.
And Alfonso Tucker couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that someone was able to figure this out all so quickly for him.
So is he going to be able to vote this time?
When we talked in February of this year, it was right before the primaries. I text with him back and forth throughout the year, and I know that he did vote, and I know that he's looking forward to voting this fall.
Alfonso's story has a happy ending, but there are a lot of bureaucratic hurdles in the way, and it took a lot of effort to eventually discover, too late for 2018, that it was just $4 stopping him from voting. Presumably, many others never get through that kind of process. And many see this as very political, don't they? Pointing out that the restrictions tend to be more common in Republican-controlled states and tend to hit groups who are more likely to vote for the Democrats. Across the country, do we know how many people, some in prison, but many more who are now out, have been disenfranchised by these laws?
Well, in 2016, one estimate said that there were 6.1 million Americans who were disenfranchised because of a felony conviction. And that's just an extraordinary number. The most significant place where this has an effect is in Florida, which was one of a handful of states that had a lifetime voting ban on people with felony convictions. In 2018, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment that repealed that lifetime ban.
Thank you. I want a little bit of news out of Florida. One of the ballot initiatives in Florida that has raised a lot of national attention has been Amendment 4, which would restore voting rights to felons. This affects over a million potential voters.
But Florida lawmakers quickly implemented a law that required people to repay all fines and fees they owe as part of their sentence before they can vote again.
An update here at 5, the Florida Supreme Court has affirmed that felons must pay up before they can register to vote.
Essentially putting all of these people, 1.4 million people in Florida, in the same bucket as Alfonso Tucker, you know, making them have to navigate this very confusing bureaucracy.
And Florida is an incredibly tight state, the most important state in recent elections. 1.4 million could easily swing the vote, couldn't it?
That's right. And, you know, Florida, every election there is decided by a razor-thin margin.
To show you how significant that can be, Florida went to Donald Trump in 2016 by 113,000 votes. And it's expected to be a close race this November, too.
And okay. I think it's really telling that Republicans moved very aggressively after this historic measure was passed in Florida to really limit its impact and limit the effect of it.
Okay, so this is a deeply political issue. We have a situation in which 6 million plus Americans are disenfranchised for that reason. And then on top of that, we are, of course, in the middle of a pandemic. And there are more Americans than ever voting by mail. So I want to talk about that. Do we know how many mail-in ballots there will be?
It's hard to project how many there will be, but every expert projects that there will be a record number. In a typical election, about a quarter of all votes are cast by mail. But this year, I think experts are expecting that number could go as high as 50 or even 60%.
And in theory, that's great. And I know that a number of states automatically send mail-in ballots to all registered voters. But that isn't the picture across the board, is it?
States have taken widely different approaches to handling mail-in voting. There are a couple states in the U.S. that have a long history of doing vote by mail. What the majority of states have done have said that you have to request a ballot and then we'll send you one. And traditionally, there have been a handful of states that required voters to give an excuse to vote by mail. And a big fight since the beginning of the year has been trying to push states to ease those requirements, to ease those restrictions, to make it so that anyone can request a ballot, that they don't have to give an excuse. And a few states have refused to budge on their requirements for requesting an absentee ballot. Texas is the most notable.
With the present debate over mail-in ballots, some voters in Texas are confused about what exactly is allowed in our state.
They're only letting people vote by mail if they are 65 or older, if they have a disability, if they're going to be out of their county, you know, for the entire election period. COVID in Texas is not a valid excuse to vote by mail. But
But it is in other states.
Right. It is in other states, many other states.
What other special steps do people trying to vote by mail have to take?
When you vote by mail, you have to do certain things that you don't have to do when you vote in person. You have to sign a ballot envelope. You have to sometimes get someone to witness you signing a ballot envelope. You might have to get a notary, who's someone who's formally authorized to stamp a legal document. in some states for your absentee ballot. And those are all things that voters are unfamiliar with, that they're having to navigate for the first time. And in the middle of a pandemic, that can be really hard. So there have been just a slew of lawsuits here. There have been, I think, over 250 lawsuits that have been filed this year, really challenging the rules around absentee balloting, saying that it should be as easy as possible for voters to cast their votes by mail, and that a lot of these restrictions that make sense in normal times don't make sense now. Another really important restriction is that many states require a ballot to arrive at an election office by election day in order to count, regardless of when the voter puts it in the mail. And there's been a ton of concern about that here because there have been widespread reports of delays with the Postal Service, and voters are really concerned that, you know, if they put their ballot in the mail several days ahead of time, it might not get to the election office in time to be counted.
And I've also read about differences between states in how you actually submit your ballot. So, for instance, in one place, you might have to put it inside one envelope before putting it inside another one, or you might have to make sure that the name exactly matches the name on the electoral roll. If mistakes are made in the process, what would happen to your ballot?
If you make those mistakes, your ballot can be rejected. It can go uncounted. And that's a worst case scenario. Having an eligible voter who is legally able to cast a vote, not having their ballot counted because of some technical mistake.
And do we have any sense of how wide scale that might be? And also whether there are certain groups who are more likely to have their ballot discarded than others?
In a typical election, around 1% of mail-in ballots get rejected. Not a huge percentage. But there's a ton of concern that because there are going to be more people voting by mail for the first time this year who are unfamiliar with the rules, that they're going to get caught up in these technical deficiencies and have their ballots rejected. And that number could rise astronomically. The Trump campaign has also said that they are very aggressively going to challenge absentee ballots, you know, looking for any kind of technical deficiency that would get a ballot thrown out, get rejected.
But they have to be very careful because, you know, the things with bundling and all of the things that are happening with votes by mail.
And the most alarming thing is that research has shown that the people who are most likely to have their ballot rejected are first-time voters and minorities. There's been research that in the March primary in Florida, Black voters, Hispanic voters were almost twice as likely to have their ballots rejected as white voters, which is really astounding. So there are very alarming disparities when it comes to ballot rejections.
And once again, this is an issue that skews politically because we know that far more Democrats are voting by mail this year. And speaking of politics, you mentioned delays in the Postal Service.
As we're seeing this new warning from the Postal Service, the president still refuses to support funding that would assist mail-in voting.
Yeah, he has.
Some have accused Trump himself of trying to slow things down. Tell me about what's been happening, and do we understand why?
Earlier this year, Louis DeJoy, who is a major Trump ally, a major Republican donor, was appointed to be the Postmaster General.
Today, I am honored to begin my service as our nation's 75th Postmaster General.
The top official at the Postal Service. And right after he took over, there were reports of widespread mail delays across the country.
For several weeks, we've been following the story of slowdowns in the mail system. We asked for your stories about the things you've experienced and have waited on.
And that has caused a lot of concern about, you know, the reliability of a system to handle an influx of mail-in votes. Now, Louis DeJoy said earlier this year that he halted some of the changes that he put in place that were causing some of the slowdowns.
Earlier this week, DeJoy agreed to pause plans for additional changes until after the election.
But I think there's still a lot of skepticism about the Postal Service, particularly because President Trump has openly framed it in a political way. So even though the Postal Service is repeatedly making assurances that it has the capacity to handle this election, I think there's still a lot of widespread skepticism about it.
Next, what could happen on polling day to stop people from voting?
Okay, so we've talked about various ways in which people might lose the chance they have to vote before Election Day. But let's talk about Election Day itself. Back in June, you covered a primary election in Georgia where voters had to wait in line for hours in the middle of a pandemic to cast a ballot.
Now to the primary day chaos. Hundreds of voters waiting in hours-long lines in the heat, some in the rain to cast their ballots. Most of the problems in the metro specifically...
Should we expect to see a repeat of those scenes on November the 3rd? And if so, who are the voters who tend to end up queuing for longest?
I think that there's no question that we're going to see long lines. Every election day in recent elections, there are voters who wind up waiting 2, 3, 4 hours in line, and there's just no excuse for that. There's been research that has shown that minority voters are much more likely to wait longer in line than their white counterparts. And most troublingly, I think that the longer someone waits in line, the likelihood that they will vote in the next election decreases. So that's certainly a concern.
And just tell me about the technology for a minute, because in Britain, basically when you vote, you get a pencil, you put a cross on a page and you post it into a box. Very old-fashioned. Tell me about whether there are any additional risks when you're using machines like the ones you're talking about?
Well, every state kind of has their different machines that they use. Some states use a paper ballot, you know, where you fill it out with a pen and then put it into a machine. Some states use, you know, you make your choice on a screen. But every election day, we see that there are scanners or machines that break down. There are power outages. There's a scramble to get machines to precincts where machines aren't working. And I think that will continue to be an issue this year.
What other on-the-day issues are you concerned about?
Well, one thing that's top of mind is voter intimidation. President Trump has encouraged his supporters to go to the polls and to watch.
I'm urging my supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, because that's what has to happen. I am urging them to do it. And I am urging my people. I hope it's going to be a fair election. If it's a fair election, I am 100% on board. But if I see tens of thousands of ballots being manipulated, I can't go along with that.
And that's just very clearly an intimidating suggestion. You know, who knows, are there going to be people who are harassing people in line, who are going to be protesting, you know, near polling places? And I think that's one major concern, is whether we're going to see a kind of voter intimidation at the polls on Election Day.
It's not just the president. His son, Donald Trump Jr., posted a video on Facebook that talked about the radical left and fraud.
The radical left are laying the groundwork to steal this election from my father, President.
And used really militarized language, saying Republicans needed an army to go watch people vote, saying enlist now.
We need every able-bodied man, woman to join Army for Trump's election security operation at defendyourballot.com and enlist today.
And since then, Facebook have actually said they'll take down any posts that appear to recommend intimidation at the polls. But look, Trump's campaign don't say that this is about intimidation. So what is their justification?
Their justification is that they're there to prevent fraud.
Fraud that you said doesn't exist.
Right. It's fraud that doesn't exist. There are laws on the books that allow people to observe at the polls, but there's a really fine line between being an observer, respectfully, you know, making sure that everything is going smoothly, and intimidating people. And I think there is widespread concern that there could be a situation where it could get really ugly at the polls.
It's clearly going to be an extraordinarily busy day for you. But what about once counting begins? Normally, we get a result in the evening. It sounds like that might not happen this time. What will you be watching out for on the night?
Normally on election night, we have a projected winner, and news networks are able to project that based on a combination of exit polls, of votes reported, and the margins between the candidates. But the challenge this year is that because a majority of the ballots might be coming in by mail, the votes that are being reported first on election night might not reflect the majority of the vote total. Some states are prohibited from even beginning to count their mail-in ballots until election day, including key states of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And counting those mail-in ballots just takes a long time. They have to verify all the information on the ballot envelope. They have to open the envelopes. They have to scan the ballots. And it's a lot harder than just inserting the ballot into the machine, like people do in person, and then they get a reading of the vote.
The Americans need to come over to Sunderland and they'll show you how to count them all in a night.
I think what I'm going to be watching for is how President Trump approaches the election night returns. If it appears that he is ahead on election night, will he come out and try and claim victory early before all the votes are counted? I think that's a very dangerous scenario. It would lend the impression that the vote is being stolen from him as more ballots are counted. Or are both campaigns going to wait until all the ballots are counted? I think it's difficult to see a situation where President Trump doesn't try and claim victory if he's ahead. But I think that's the thing that will be most worth watching on election night. And also to watch how the media networks handle reporting the results. In America, you know, there's a long tradition of news anchors sit around a table and they kind of at the top of every hour, you know, call state by state as the polls close. And usually you have a sense of who won the election by 11 o'clock or midnight.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race. CNN projects Donald Trump wins the presidency. The business tycoon and a TV personality.
And I don't think that they're going to be able to do that this year. And I think there's still a real kind of confusion and uncertainty among the American public about why that's the case. And I'm eager to see how networks approach conveying that we just won't know, that there's still uncertainty while still kind of conveying confidence in the election.
That's it for today. Many thanks to Anushka Rastana and Sam Levine. This episode first aired on Today in Focus, The Guardian's global news podcast. If you liked it, you can find more by searching for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Martha Lee Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier and additional production by Miles Herbert. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.